You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Yesterday, the newly elected Egyptian parliament met for the first time since last year's popular uprising forced President Hosni Mubarak from power after a 30-year reign. And tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the Day of Revolt, the start of the Egyptian uprising in Tahrir Square. To commemorate the occasion, HBO 2 will screen a documentary called In Tahrir Square, 18 Days of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution. And joining us now are filmmakers John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. And from Cairo, journalist Sharif Abdel Kudus, an independent journalist based in the Egyptian capital, who's also a correspondent for the TV radio show Democracy Now! And a fellow at the Nation Institute. The film airs tomorrow night on HBO 2 at 8 p.m., and I'm very pleased that it brings John, Matthew, and Sharif to our show. Hi.
Hi, Lenny. How are you?
Now, John, Jonathan Jones of The Guardian has called the revolution a secular liberal fantasy. Do you see his point?
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I just thought it was an exciting moment when people band together and move an immovable object, and we saw it. It was invigorating, so I don't agree with that. I think it's a start, and it's not the finish, but it's not a fantasy.
Well, I think that, and Sharif might want to jump in here, that's because the people imagined it as being something that was going to have a positive result, and now some people are saying the end result with so many Islamist parties in power might turn out to be something quite different than the secularists imagined.
Well, I think, and thank you for having me on, I think certainly the parliament is not the end result of the revolution. We're 1 year from when this all began, and many feel the revolution still has a long way to go, and that the real struggle right now is against the regime that has really ruled Egypt since 1952, which is the military regime, which is essentially a state within the state that enjoys political and economic autonomy above any kind of civilian oversight, that has a share of the Egyptian economy ranging from 10 to 35%. It's hard to know the details because it's cloaked in secrecy. And right now, the military is brought to the helm of political power on February 11th when Mubarak was forced out of office. The Supreme Council of Armed Forces has been ruling the country and still is ruling the country. They still have the position of the executive over the parliament. And so the main charge of this body really is to draft the constitution. So, you know, the revolution arose, I think, a year ago because of really a decade of growing resistance to the Mubarak regime that was laid the groundwork by the labor movement with a lot of strikes and sit-ins, and that really exploded on January 25th, as the whole world saw. But certainly, you know, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, was always destined to do well in any post-Mubarak election. They're an 80-year-old organization. They've been contesting elections since the early 80s, and they have a very vast grassroots network and a very disciplined get-out-the-vote campaign. So I think this is just the beginning, as John mentioned, and the revolution still has a long way to go.
That's why you're calling it an unfinished revolution. But it was my sense that the military saw the popular uprising as a way for the public to effect a coup on their behalf, at least not at the very beginning, but as it progressed, they saw this as an opportunity to get rid of Mubarak and take power themselves.
I think the military doesn't want to govern the day-to-day affairs of the country. The military has, in effect, been in power since 1952 for the past 60 years. Every president has been drawn from their ranks, and many governors and ministers are drawn from their ranks. And like I said, they have a special privilege in the country, and so they're above any civilian oversight. But I think in the beginning of the revolution, they protected Mubarak. I mean, on the day what's called here the Battle of the Camel on February 2nd, when Mubarak sent in his thugs to try and retake Tahrir Square, which is featured in the film, the army stood by and let them in. I mean, the army was deployed in Tahrir and had the tanks on all the entrances and let them in. But I think they quickly realized that the revolution was not going away, it was only growing, and that Mubarak was a lost cause. And so he was forced out. And right now, I think their main concern is handing over authority of dealing with the country's day-to-day affairs back to a civilian leadership that preserves their special status in the country. They've made it very clear in a document in November called the Silmi document, where they laid out some so-called constitutional principles that they want to govern the writing of the constitution. And in that, they said the military budget should remain secret above any kind of parliamentary oversight, that they wanted to be able to have veto power over parts of the constitution, and to be able to be involved, involve themselves in political life, civilian political life. And so they made it very clear what their intentions are before handing power back to a so-called civilian government.
Matthew, Amnesty International called the military regime the most serious erosion of human rights since Mubarak stepped down.
I think if you see what the military was capable of and capable of allowing in the film, you know, when Sheila Nevin sent us over there for HBO, we didn't know how things were going to turn out. And Sharif was already in the street reporting on the violence that was happening and showing the abuses of the military regime. And I think part of what is important a year later is to go back and see the hope and the efforts of the people during those 18 days of the revolution. They didn't know what was going to happen, yet they kept themselves out there every day.
Well, Sharif mentioned that the pro-Mubarak supporters were paid to protest, although I am always worried about those kinds of accusations. Putin said that the protesters in Moscow were paid by Hillary Clinton to protest. So that would cost a lot of money. But did you ever consider interviewing one of the president's supporters to find out why he'd come out to protest against the protesters?
Well, actually, we found the guys that rode the camels into the square, because we had been to Egypt previously and we had taken a camel ride. It's the tourist ride that you take to the pyramids, and made good friends with them. And I said, you know, who has camels that can come into the square? It's got to be these guys. And it was. And they explained a couple of things. The tourism had gone way down. And they sort of needed somebody to blame for this. And Mubarak said, yeah, it's the guys in the square. Come on, let's go. They did say that they had gotten paid. I don't know if that's the case. But these were basically disgruntled camel drivers who wanted the revolution over so they could get tourists back at the pyramids.
Well, there's always somebody who's benefiting from a dictatorship and somebody who is losing because of what the authoritarian government is doing. There's always somebody who thinks that a Mubarak is a great idea.
Can I make a point on that?
Sure.
Just to be clear, there was like maybe two camels that entered Tahrir Square that day and maybe three horses. It was just a very iconic image, and you know, it was named the Battle of the Camel after that. But the people who came in, these are not new forces that were Mubarak supporters. He'd been used them many times in the past, most notably during election times, to beat opposition officials or to block voting stations. He's deployed these kinds of thug forces before, so it's not new. It's just, I think, the first time that the whole world was seeing it. To be honest, since the Supreme Council has taken over, the abuses and the squashing of dissent has been actually worse. There's been a deterioration in the right to protest.
Although the head of Egypt's military council announced Tuesday that the state of emergency will be lifted. Did they tell us when?
It will be lifted except in cases of thuggery, which is a very, very wide definition, and thuggery usually is a term that is applied to protesters. So just to make that clear, but also to make clear, in the last 3 months alone, nearly 90 people have been killed protesting peacefully in the streets. So the most egregious, the bloodiest day since Mubarak's ouster was October 9th, when the military, this is not police, this is an army soldiers, driving armored personnel carriers and using live ammunition on protests of mostly Coptic Christians and their supporters. 27 people were killed on that day on October 9th. So there's been a severe crackdown on dissent here. There's been a severe crackdown on the media. And so I think these are the key issues right now.
Well, the protests started peacefully, didn't they, Matthew? then the military started to attack the protesters. Did that change the movement? Do you think that it encouraged more people actually to come out and join it?
Well, Sharif was there on the streets. We came a few days after that to join him. And my understanding is that once the repression started, more and more people came and stood with their fellow Egyptians in the street.
In your previous films, John, you put a camera on your shoulder and went out and did the reporting yourself. Would it have been possible in this situation?
There were lots of cameras there. Our really good camera got taken away at the airport.
Taken away? Why did they take it away? Did they give a reason?
They were trying to keep reporters from reporting on what was going on in Tahrir. We managed to slip a consumer camera past the customs agents. And so actually we weren't that well equipped, but we've got quite a bit of experience covering revolutions all over the world. And some of the things that you're talking about, the use of thugs, I've seen the Chinese do this after Tiananmen Square. They took back Shanghai with an army of thugs because they don't want to appear to be doing it themselves. During the Olympics, when there were riots in the street in Korea and the Korean government was sort of shaken back and forth, they sent thugs to combat the protesters. So this is something that repressive regimes employ all over the world. And it was really, you know, the night before Mubarak left, I thought they were going to attack us because I had been in these places before. It felt really eerie. It was dark and nobody knew what was going to happen.
Well, the sense was he was not going to cave in.
It seemed like it. And when his resignation was announced, it was almost a moment in which people didn't believe what was happening. They've been dreaming about it. They've been fighting for it. Then all of a sudden it came. And when I watched Sharif cry, I felt the joy and happiness that he and the other Egyptians felt at that moment.
Well, Sharif, what made you think that the violence against protesters wouldn't be, as you say, this bad, or that Mubarak wouldn't stoop to this level, as you say in the film? Wasn't the earlier example in Tunisia a warning, I guess, to all the autocrats of the Middle East?
Well, the revolution broke out on January 25th, and that was police day in Egypt, and that's the reason the protest was scheduled for that day. Tens of thousands went out that day. They took Tahrir, and it was retaken back. What really happened on January 28th was probably the most decisive day of the revolution yet, when pretty much millions hit the streets and overwhelmed the Interior Ministry's security forces, which are police and state security forces and central security forces, who have really been the apparatus to squash dissent in Mubarak's era, very brutal and violent. And they were overwhelmed. So it seemed like the main tool of Mubarak's regime to put down physically protests had been overcome. And it seemed that because of the sheer number of people that had hit the streets that were in Tahrir, and not just in Tahrir, this was all in all cities around Egypt, that the use of violence wouldn't try violence again to try and take the square.
But it's been working in Syria. Assad continues to remain in power.
Right. Well, I think it's a very different situation in Syria in terms of the military acting more as a militia of the regime. I think Mubarak's problem here is that if he had tried, or senior generals had tried, to issue an order for the army to open fire on Egyptian civilians, they very well may have had just a breakdown in the order of command, the chain of command, because I doubt that many of the Egyptian soldiers who really are drawn from broad swaths of the population and are not that loyal to the regime necessarily would have obeyed a command to kill unarmed protesters. So there was that issue as well. But, you know, and like I said in the film, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. I mean, this was a cornered animal that was being forced out. And so, you know, that's when they tend to lash out.
We're talking to the people behind the film Tahrir Square, 18 Days of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution, which will be broadcast tomorrow night on HBO 2 at 8 p.m. Sharif Abdulkudus is an independent journalist based in Cairo, and he's talking to us from the Egyptian capital. Also with us are filmmakers John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill, and we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Sharif Abdul-Quddus, who is an independent journalist, was working here in New York for Democracy Now. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute, but he has decided to stay in Egypt following the fall of Hosni Mubarak. And he is the person who we follow in a new film called Tahrir Square, 18 Days of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution. The filmmakers are John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. You open the film with footage from Asmas Mahfouz's video on Facebook that's a call to arms for a revolution in Tahrir Square. How many women did you see protesting in Tahrir Square?
Many women of all different shapes, sizes, backgrounds, economic status. There were well-educated women who could be living somewhere in Brooklyn Heights. And there are women that came off the farm to protest. And but I think that's one reason why the revolution succeeded.
But you don't deal, Matthew, with the way women were treated while you were there. Hadn't some of them been sexually assaulted, including a horrifying incident that involved Lara Logan of CBS News?
There have been many different horrifying incidents over the last year, not just with journalists, but also with many different Egyptian women on the streets who have been protesting since, you know, those 18 days, those initial 18 days of revolution. And I think what our film does is put you in the center of the revolution as it happened. So what our cameras saw did not include that abuse. But you get the emotional experience of being in the center of Tahrir Square as the revolution unfolds, as Mubarak's forces attack people in the square, and in the end, as the crowd of millions around you cheers the fall of the dictator.
Sharif, haven't women been subjected to virginity tests when they've been interrogated by the military? Actually, 12,000 people have been tried in closed military courts. That's since the fall of Mubarak. What are they being tried for, and why would a woman have to go through a virginity test if she is being questioned about other kinds of activities?
Well, certainly this is all part of the military's very grave breach of human rights during the time that they have been controlling the country. They've been starting military trials actually since January 28th when they first deployed. As you said, more than 12,000 have been tried. These really are mark a very grave deterioration in basic due process rights. Some people were just tried in a group in a kitchen, and within a matter of hours, their families did not know what was happening to them, sentenced to a few months to many years in prison for things such as breaking curfew, or they added a new crime called thuggery. Many activists have been put on these trials. But actually, one of the most successful grassroots campaigns in 2011 has been the No to Military Trials campaign, and what was once very difficult to raise the issue of speaking out against the army right after February 11th when Mubarak stepped down became a very widespread campaign against military trials, and the practice has all but been abolished. Very few get referred to military courts anymore. And of course, as you mentioned, the notorious incident of these so-called virginity tests, these forced violations of women that happened on March 9th after a protest, a sit-in in Tahrir Square was violently dispersed by police and backed by plainclothes thugs. Hundreds of people were arrested. They were taken into the nearby Egyptian museum where the army and military police had set up a headquarters. And several women were subjected to these so-called virginity tests, which were really horrifying. Other people were beaten with hoses and cables and electrocuted. So this was, you know, the start. This was a month in to the Supreme Council of Armed Forces rule in Egypt. But let me just add also a very significant court victory. A very brave woman by the name of Samira Ibrahim spoke out against what happened to her. She was one of those who had been subjected to one of these virginity tests. And despite fierce criticism against her, pursued a legal case against the military and recently won an administrative court ruling in December, which was hailed as a great victory.
I guess those tests are a way of humiliating people and intimidating them. But over the weekend, the Supreme Council ordered the release of 1,959 detainees, including many bloggers and journalists. So is that a positive sign?
Well, I think the fight is going on. And you know, we can point out all the bad things that are happening, But if we look at our own revolution, how many decades did it take for us to get rid of slavery, to give women the vote? I mean, we're still a work in progress here. And the exciting thing about the Egyptian Revolution is that it's attracted people like Sharif. Sharif could have a wonderful life here in the United States. He was well-employed, he was well-respected, and he's chosen to stay in Egypt because he wants that revolution to succeed. When the military does something wrong, his voice is crying about it. You're doing something about that today, Lenny, when we're talking about this program, HBO, by broadcasting this. I think we all want democracy to succeed, and you don't make a revolution in one day, you don't make it in 18 days.
The sense often is, okay, now the dictator has been toppled, and everything is going to be great.
That's right. The Hollywood movie would end with the dictator falling and democracy blossoms. But you know, the inspiration from this that I continue to take is that people made it happen, that constantly applying pressure is the same thing that, you know, we can do here in the United States. When you constantly apply that pressure and keep up that fight, as Sharif is keeping up, you can affect change.
Well, Sharif, you have a role model in your uncle, Mohammed Abdel Quddus. He has been protesting for a long time, hasn't he? And he was jailed during the protest?
Yeah, my uncle is a longtime dissident journalist, and he's head of something called the Freedoms Committee at the Journalist Syndicate. And he's very well known for protesting, standing out on the steps of the Journalist Syndicate with a megaphone and a flag for years. And under Mubarak, when you did protest, you would be very quickly surrounded by 10 times the number of security forces. He's been arrested and jailed, I think, something close to 15 times, or somewhere between 11 and 15. And yes, he was arrested on the second day of the revolution on January 26th, and a very famous photograph of him being dragged by five plainclothes police officers and hauled off to jail was circulated widely. He was jailed again on January 28th and driven out into the desert and let go there. It's a tactic they do just to get people out of the way.
So they just leave him out in the desert and say, okay, find your way back to Cairo?
Exactly. I mean, not like in middle of dunes, but, you know, on the outskirts of the city. And so you just kind of have to walk a little bit and get back into the city proper. And that's just something they've been known to do. And so he's continued his resistance against the military regime here, and continues to hold a lot of press conferences speaking out against issues like military trials and such.
Although he said this is not his uprising, he hoped for something different?
Well, I think he hopes, as we all do here in Egypt, and a lot of us have hope, that, as you said, you know, the dictator was toppled, but the dictatorship wasn't. So we're still looking to have freedom, to have the right of expression, to have reformed security forces. And the chants that really echoed through the streets and echoed since the beginning of this revolution was bread, freedom, and social justice. That was one of the main the chants of this revolution, and people are still fighting for that. And I think what happened on January 25th, many talk about how this barrier of fear was broken. I don't think that people were afraid. I think it's that they didn't have hope, and that's the gift that Tunisia gave to Egypt, is that it showed, here's what the dream can be, here's what you can accomplish. And so it gave people hope that if they hit the streets and they really engaged in this kind of revolution, that they can achieve something. And I think that's something that most people here still have.
It's hard to believe that it's been a year. Tomorrow will be the one-year anniversary when Tahrir Square suddenly became the place of a major uprising. It's the reason I'm speaking with John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill about their documentary called In Tahrir Square, 18 Days of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution, along with Sharif Abdel Quddus, who is the central figure in this documentary. He's the one who shows us around because he's multilingual. He speaks Arabic, and he can speak as you reveal to us in a couple of scenes. You can speak street slang along with the higher form of Egyptian Arabic. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The ultra-conservative Salafist Al-Nur Party won the second most parliamentary seats 29% of the vote in the parliamentary election. Did that come as a surprise to you, Sharif?
That did, actually. I think the Noor Party actually got close to 25%, but still much higher than myself and many people here had expected. Salafis, of course, as you mentioned, practice ultra-conservative Islam. They have a wide network of mosques, especially in rural areas of Egypt, that really helped with their campaigning. And they have now, a quarter of the parliament. The big question is, will they ally with the kingmaker, which is the Brotherhood, which has about 47%? So far, it seems that, that those two will not come together, and maybe the Brotherhood will ally with some other smaller parties, maybe liberal parties. It remains to be seen, but that was something that few had predicted, that many seats won by this group.
Do you think they'll be willing to make an accommodation with the military leaders, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces?
The Salafis, well, I think possibly. I mean, the Brotherhood themselves have shown during this transitional period an unwillingness to confront the military council and to... Many of the revolutionary youth blame them and say they cozied up to the generals in order to just have their elections and get their seats in parliament and have not challenged these key issues of their military budget or their crackdowns on protests here. So that's what's really coming up in these next 6 months. The timetable right now is for a 100-member body to be appointed by this parliament that will write the constitution, they'll be put to a referendum, and then we'll have presidential elections supposedly before the end of June and a handover of power. And the question is, will the Brotherhood, which effectively controls half of parliament, will they allow the military a safe exit? And will they be able to hand over this authority and not be held accountable for crimes committed and not be subject to scrutiny of their budget and their economic dealings?
What about the other people in Egypt, secularists and Copts and other minorities? Is the divide between them and the Islamists wider than it was a year ago?
Is it sort of like the way we New Yorkers feel about what's going on in South Carolina?
You're asking Sharif that question.
Yeah, because I mean, we sit here in New York and there's things going on in parts of our country. We're just scratching our head, and these people are winning elections.
Right. I mean, I don't know that the divide has grown. I mean, what already has started to happen is that a lot of these the elected representatives in parliament from the Noor Party have begun to moderate because they can't keep these very extreme issues on the agenda. And so we've already seen them come to the middle, much like the Brotherhood has over the last 10 years, much like the AKP party in Turkey is a very different party now than it was 10 years ago. It has moved much closer to the center. So I think, this is the benefit of having a free and open democracy where people are held accountable for their actions and for what they say. The military really cracked down on Coptic Christians on that night of October 9th, and they have done in other incidents as well the same kinds of attacks because they feel that they can get away with it. The Mubarak regime also used to try and inflame these divisions to blame Islamists and kind of create divisions within society to keep themselves in power. So this is not something new in Egypt, unfortunately.
Well, during the Mubarak years, we heard all sorts of things about Israel, despite the fact that there was a peace treaty with Israel, including chewing gum that functioned as an aphrodisiac that the Israelis were giving to young, innocent Egyptian women. More recently, Israel was accused of putting sharks off the beaches of Egypt to discourage tourism. Do you think that's going to get worse? Is this going to? Do you think that relations with Israel will sour, if anything?
I'm not sure what will happen. I think the Brotherhood's given clear indications that they want to keep peace with Israel. I think parts of the Camp David Accords they're looking to renegotiate. Egypt doesn't really have real sovereignty over Sinai. Like, for example, the army can't go in there. People are very, very upset about a gas deal that the Mubarak regime had negotiated with Israel, where the market rate was fixed, and so we were basically exporting natural gas to Israel at a discounted rate. So these are things that people want to have looked at again. And of course, there's a serious anger at Israel's complete siege of Gaza, of its assault on Gaza in 2008 and 2009, and of Egypt's complicity in the siege of Gaza by closing the border of Rafah. And so these are things that they want changed. They want to have solidarity with Palestinians. And we supposedly opened the border in May in Rafah, but I personally went to Gaza in June, and the border is still very, very restricted.
Now, what is the feeling about the U.S. politics? Did any of you get any sense about whether President Obama is popular in Egypt, or whether the United States is also being blamed for Egypt's problems because we remain such a staunch ally of Mubarak over all those years?
I think in the film, Obama is personally thanked by one gentleman on the night of the triumph, and he felt that Obama's withdrawal of support for Mubarak was one of the things that toppled that wall. I think that in the excitement of the triumph, everybody was celebrated. Obama was celebrated. We as Americans were celebrated. Egyptians were patting themselves on the back. Now it's the hard work.
John Alpert, Matthew O'Neill, filmmakers behind In Tahrir Square, 18 Days of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution, and Sharif Abdel Kudus, who is speaking to us from Cairo. Are you still working with Democracy Now?
Yes, I'm still a correspondent for them, and I'll be on the show tomorrow.
And the film is airing tomorrow night on HBO 2 at 8 p.m. Thank you all for being on our show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.